Can't Say That is a sociology podcast that poses more questions than answers. Join your hosts, Drs. Nama Carlin and Melanie White, in a journey to make the familiar unknown.
We are back at the studio with You Can't Say That, a sociological podcast that poses more questions than answers. I'm Nama Carlin.
And I'm Melanie White.
So good to be here.
So good to be here, rested and recovered. So very happy.
In our fancy studio.
Do you know we have a new studio? It's absolutely amazing. And one of the most exciting things is we have sound effects.
Oh, yes, we do. We don't need to go through all of those, but we do have sound effects. So that's very exciting. Melanie has already pressed all of them. We have checked all of them.
I have been advised to use the sound effects sparingly. Yeah. And I may have promised to try. Nama, who are we talking about today?
Today is one of our best episodes, actually. I think it's my favorite. This episode is everything. Mm. It's got Jacques Derrida. It's got a cat. What else do you need in the world? I'm wearing my cat shirt.
And for those of you who don't know Nama's cat shirt.
No, because podcasting is not a visual medium.
No. That's right. It's an oral medium. Uh-huh. So allow me to read what's on Nama's cat shirt. It says, "I'd rather be hanging out with my cat."
Indeed.
Note. Nama Carlin does not have a cat.
Not yet, though.
So this is the future that will have been.
This is the future that the liberals want. Me to have a cat.
Now, what's interesting about Derrida is that we actually spoke to him a few episodes ago.
Correct.
And that was in the context of a juxtaposition with the first thinker that we discussed in our podcast, René Descartes. Mm-hmm. And now that we're closing into the end, this is our penultimate episode, it's a nice opportunity to return to Derrida's critique of Descartes. And in this particular episode, we're going to be considering the last lecture one of the last lectures that he gave, titled The Animal That Therefore I Am, delivered in 1997 in Cerecy. And do you know the story about this lecture? It's absolutely amazing to me.
I do know the story, but can you tell it?
Well, he had prepared a speech, and he was already very, very ill. He was suffering from pancreatic cancer, and the audience members who were there, friends, colleagues, etc., knew quite possibly that this would be the last time that they would hear him speak under such circumstances. And so he gave the first lecture, and they asked him if he would speak more, and he didn't have anything prepared. And he ended up speaking, though, for something like a total of 10 hours.
Yep.
And I think it's just, I have visions of everyone hanging on his word and just sort of there in a moment knowing that something exciting was happening and that they were there in a world historic moment. So,
and nice. Just that desire to be listening and engage with some with ideas for 10 hours straight, and the capacity to just sit there and deliver. It's a moment of like history in the making.
Absolutely. And so it's this particular text, The Animal That Therefore I Am, that actually for me really inspired me to think about more in terms of my own research and work, what was actually going on with Derrida and what was the nature of his critique. And so I'm really quite indebted to this moment in this particular text, because even the title, The Animal That Therefore I Am, is a play on a deconstruction of Descartes' cogito, I think, therefore I am.
It kind of ending our series with the same, in a sense, in the deconstructive sense, with kind of Descartes as well, not just Derrida. So we have the ghost of Descartes haunting the studio.
Well, that, You know, it's that interesting sense of when one thinks about Derrida, one thinks about deconstruction. Mm. And it's a nice homage if we return back to Descartes, for whom there's that sense of destruction, the idea of these scholastic principles that were no longer able to support his knowledge end up needing to be destroyed and eliminated for him to start fresh. And Derrida's deconstruction is something quite different, but it is also that sense of a method or an approach that distinguishes between what is and what it is not. Mm. So the me versus the not me.
So the integral elements of critique are always already present in the work. With that in mind, what is Derrida's key question then in this text? The full title is, of this text, is The Animal That Therefore I Am, brackets, More to Follow. Mm. I think that's a really interesting title that itself can be an entire, not a 10-hour lecture, but definitely a 2-hour lecture just in the title.
Well, let's try and break it down maybe a little bit this is an interesting oral medium, because visually, if you compare Descartes' Cogito, I think therefore I am, against Derrida's The Animal That Therefore I Am. When you place those phrases one on top of the other, you can see that there's a replacement or a substitution. Derrida has replaced Descartes' I with the animal. Mm-hmm. And so when looking at it in those terms, I think therefore I am, the animal that therefore I am, it prompts that recognition of, oh, hey, wait a minute, I am an animal.
I think that's like a dun 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 moment, but we don't have a sound effect. Not the crickets moment.
Okay. Never let Melanie alone with recording equipment.
So this is a really salient point. Derrida is doing something that so many of the theorists that we looked at in this podcast, effectively, they looked at the point of difference between the animal and the human. And as we progressed, we looked at those who considered points of similarity. And what Derrida is saying is actually, y'all have got it completely wrong in saying, where are the points of similarity, difference? We've actually positioned the animal and the human as separate entities. And when in fact, I, the human, am always already animal. Hmm. And how we think about the question of animal, and this was what we did with our first episode on Derrida, was that this division of animality versus human shapes politically how we respond not only to non-human beings, but how we really orient our justice system, our legal system, politics, the notion of who possesses rights, who has the right to live, and under what circumstances. I like this argument that Derrida presents. It's common to see accusations against Derrida as being apolitical in his work, or just completely vague, or in the realm of the theoretical, i.e. the theoretical that isn't in the world of the living. And I think that as theorists, that's something that rubs us the wrong way. And this is an extremely political, profound point. What does it mean to say I the human? It means always already I the animal.
I couldn't agree more. And I think that there's...
You couldn't agree less either.
I am animal. If I'm thinking back to Descartes and this dialogue that Derrida is establishing with Descartes, and just thinking about Descartes' line, I think, therefore I am. Descartes posits the capacity for thinking as a condition for selfhood. And yet in Derrida's substitution, the animal that therefore I am, the animal becomes a condition for selfhood. And so this is a really nice thematic that I think follows on from your point about linking back to the various thinkers that we've been considering so far, where in this very succinct philosophical move, there's a lovely substitution which demonstrates something that we already are, if not already know. I think. So it's the magic that Derrida gives us in this title of the text isn't exhausted with just these observations about its resonance with Descartes. You mentioned the brackets, more to follow, end bracket. And this is actually rather cheeky. What's interesting in terms of the French formulation, the title is L'animal que donc je suis à suivre. The animal that therefore I am. What's interesting is when you conjugate the verb être, je suis, which means I am, it phonically sounds the same as je suis, I follow. And so Derrida is such a playful man, and this linguistic play here actually becomes quite meaningful when we think about, well, who comes first? Is it the self, or is it the self, that is the I, or is it the animal? And it's the who follows after the animal. Is it the I? And when you are following someone, you're always following someone ahead of you, and yet following, is it in time? Are you following someone in time, or is it the condition for you, your leading?
So to follow after.
Yeah, so it's quite an interesting thing. So when you say, I follow someone, you, Nama Carlin, follow Derrida, that is, he is your intellectual hero. Derrida is someone who exists prior in time to you, and not only that, but you follow the logic, the argument, etc., of his teaching, we would put it that way. But it could also be that to follow someone is to follow them in terms of space. So where there's that sense of being first in space is that we end up actually physically being after them.
Can you say that again? I don't really follow.
That was awesome.
Can I just return quickly? Had some time to mull over your point, and when it seems important to me that you said I follow Derrida, but he is in a point of time before me.
Oh, you're following me now.
I'm following you now. In this sense, that who comes first, in fact, is back in time.
Yes.
And so you are following something that isn't necessarily there anymore.
Yes.
So it's following this absence in a way that is made all the more meaningful, not meaningful, but it exists simply in your following something that isn't there anymore. So who comes first? What comes first? Who do we follow? Does the human follow the animal? Mm. So if we just think about the evolution, in a sense, does the amoeba come first and then the human? Or is it first the human and then the amoeba?
Yes, exactly. The following question is quite fascinating because when you return back to Descartes and I think, therefore I am, that sense of thinking gives a capacity to know.
And to be, that thinking is a condition to being.
Yes, and so in Derrida's hands, though, the uncertainty associated with whether or not one is first or following, or the nature of what following is in general, demonstrates a certain kind of trace, especially when you're talking about, okay, well, what if that thing isn't there anymore? And is it first? Is it gone? And Derrida will use the language of traces, you know, that we follow these traces in whatever course of study. And for me, it comes back to that question of knowledge, because we can't know for certain who comes first, the animal or the human. It really depends on the perspective or vantage that we're adopting when we're posing that question.
We spend a good time talking about the title, but not about the text.
Well, the text is so tremendously hard. This is a thing that boggles my mind. The opening paragraphs, I could spend hours working them through because they are so complicated. So the text opens in this marvelous way, and it's marvelous because I'm sure that we've all at different points either had such an experience or, you know, been unnerved in a similar way. And I think that for you, Nama, as cat lover, you have a specific, special affinity for this particular moment.
This is how the reading starts. What animal? Question. The other. I often ask myself, just to see who I am, and who I am, in brackets, following at the moment, end brackets, when, caught naked, in silence, by the gaze of an animal. For example, the eyes of a cat. I have trouble, yes, a bad time, overcoming my embarrassment. Whence this malaise? Oh. Derrida has been caught by a cat.
Oh, Nami, you read that so beautifully. You know, I just think this is so, I mean, it's interesting to me because I think about dude. So dude's standing there. And
coming out of the shower.
Coming out of the shower, towelling naked. Off. And he's got, you know, he's got his equipment there. And his cat is sitting there looking at him. And there is something really unnerving sometimes about looking into a cat's eyes. A cat can look at you and completely disarm you. Not every time, but every once in a while, it's almost like there's this primordial knowledge. And to me, I love how Derrida sets this up. Like, it's not like he comes out of the shower and lo and behold, a termite looks at him or his stick insect. rather, it's a cat. And a cat has a series of evocations about insight and knowledge and charm and magic, etc. And so he's standing there completely arrested by this cat looking at him and his junk.
But I think that this is probably one of the most my favorite texts that I've ever written about being caught naked in front of your pet. Absolutely.
Whence this malaise? Ooh. And so, you know, this idea of then it's like when you've been caught out coming out of the shower, and when you're alone, you're just completely with yourself. But suddenly there you have an animal, the animal, this cat, the other, facing you. And yet there is this instinct to want to cover up.
Absolutely. What? How would you even go about your day doing your thing? And then suddenly it's not till the moment that someone else looks at you and sees you in your nakedness that you realize that you are naked. And it's not, it's like you said, it's the cat. Who cares that a cat sees you naked?
Well, and this is the interesting thing. I think it's, you know, why does it matter? Derrida's interesting because he goes on and he says, I have trouble. I can't give it the gravitas that Nama has given her reading. But he says something like, quote, I have trouble repressing a reflex dictated by immodesty, trouble keeping silent within me a protest against the indecency, against the impropriety that comes of finding oneself naked, one's sex exposed, stark naked before a cat that looks at you without moving, just to see. And it's in that just to see, you know, what is that thing there? What is it? And yet, for Derrida, there is the experience of the desire to cover up, and yet the rationalization of, this is just a cat, this doesn't matter. I shouldn't feel shame, or I should feel shame. There's the uncertainty that comes through mediating this process of whether or not it is appropriate or proper or completely ridiculous to want to cover oneself up in front of a cat. Oh, pardon me, Logos. I just need to cover my sex.
And Derrida is very clear with us, so we don't actually think that this is a hypothetical situation. He says, I must make it clear from the start. The cat I'm talking about is a real cat. Believe me, a little cat. And indeed, Derrida has a cat called Logos, as Melanie said. Cute little Logos, little Siamese cat.
You know, it's funny about having this cat and this problem, because I'm interested in what you said a little bit earlier, Nama, where you said that one of the things about theory is that people often assume that it's generated in an abstraction and that it somehow is disjointed from an everyday lived reality. And yet we have had, each of us, this experience of being arrested. Maybe it's not coming out of the shower, but a moment where an animal, a cat, sees you in a way that, just like that James Cameron movie, Avatar, I see you. And there's something where your soul is bared. And in bearing that soul, there is that moment of feeling arrested and disarmed and without that normal balance. And yet that this is a real experience ends up becoming the prompt or the condition or the point of entry into a serious deconstructed text of Descartes that works to expose the continuities and uncertainties between the human and the animal.
I think that the point that you made is so interesting, but one of the things to point out from here is that already we have these dualisms at play. The dualism of being naked, being caught naked, and nudity, self, other, human, animal, and could we even say Derrida and Descartes?
Yeah, that's interesting. We can also say lead and follow.
Seeing and being seen. Do you think the cat felt seen by Derrida? Do you think the cat went there, sat there, and is like, holy crap, what is he looking at? I've just been caught and I'm naked.
I suppose it's those moments when we've all come across a cat grooming themselves. and the paw goes up in the air. Oh.
And they just stare at you.
And they stare, you know.
I'm busy here.
I'm licking my parts. cleaning my stuff.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that these are the moments of seeing and being seen that just happen. And how wonderful and exciting to have that moment pulled out and explored to this depth.
Well, it occurs to me as well, if we're thinking about that, those oppositions, hearing and seeing, I don't know if it's necessarily a dualism, but it's a play on two different qualities. The seeing, the cat who seeks just to see, and yet when we return back to I think, therefore I am, I'm thinking about Derrida's use of the phonetic similarity, je suis, that you can't hear it, you can only, and nor can you actually see it, but so much of it is in context. So it's the same, the verb has the same conjugation, so you can neither see nor hear it, but the meaning only makes sense in the context in which it is presented.
We have a sense that he's ashamed of being caught by the cat. What is it to actually be exposed then? What has actually happened in this moment? It's not just he's been caught naked in front of a cat. It's that something has been exposed. He's revealed.
It's that curiosity where there's something different between being naked and being nude. And certainly I think that Derrida ends up being ashamed of being ashamed. Yeah. He's like, man, get over it. You know, this is a cat. This is just Logi Logos sitting here taking a look. So what does it mean to be ashamed in the first instance and to be ashamed of being ashamed? Mm-hmm. He says in one very nice line, he says, quote, "It is generally thought, although none of the philosophers I am about to examine actually mention it, that the property unique to animals and what in the final analysis distinguishes them from man is their being naked without knowing it. Not being naked, therefore, not having a knowledge of their nudity, in short, without consciousness of good and evil." What do you make of that? I mean, the nature of good and evil and the orientation to questions of morality through nakedness point us in the direction of the Bible.
That's the first thing that comes to mind. Genesis, the genesis of creation, humans, and knowledge itself, insofar as there's the tree of knowledge and the tree of, and other tree, I guess. I don't know. My Bible studies, my biblical knowledge is blown out the window. But this is the
we're talking about the Judaic Bible here, Nama.
I know it.
This is the Torah.
Oh no, I know.
I'm shocked.
Take my Jewish credentials. But this is what happened. The original sin, I guess, the originary sin, is the first discovery. What happened when Adam and Eve Adam and Chava took a bite of the fruit of knowledge was their discovery of their nakedness. And suddenly it wasn't just nudity, but it was the experience of being naked, exposed, vulnerable, ashamed, not because of their nakedness, but also the sin that has led them there.
Your Jewish credentials have been restored. So if we return to Genesis, the Bible says, when the woman saw that the tree was good for food and that it was a delight to the eyes and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise, she took of the fruit thereof and did eat, and she gave it also unto her husband with her, and he did eat. And the eyes of both of them were opened, and they knew that they were naked. So it's eating that fruit that engenders an awareness and a consciousness of their nakedness and their impropriety of being naked. And this is the moral moment where there is this conditioned instinct to cover up. What's fascinating is that it is just Adam and Eve in this story that end up feeling that impropriety. They became naked and knowing it, whereas all of the other animals in the Garden of Eden, the snakes, the giraffes, the kangaroos,
the cats,
the dogs, etc., all of these animals were naked without knowing it. And so we have then a juxtaposition that's established between, on the one hand, those animals who are naked but don't know it, and human beings who are the animals that are naked and know it.
If they are naked without knowing that it, are they in fact naked?
Well, I think this is where Derrida has a lovely little play with us. And I know in reading and conversation and teaching this, my students are just, their eyes seem to go woo around in circles because honestly, he'll say from that point on, naked without knowing it, animals would not be in truth be naked. And you can see somehow, if I were a cartoonist, I could have the steam coming from the head and my own head. They wouldn't be naked, Derrida says, because they are naked, because it is naked without existing in nakedness. The animal neither feels nor sees itself naked, and it therefore is not naked. And so the combination of the eyes rotating in the socket, the steam coming from the scalp, the nervous shifting in the seat, it becomes, as one very intelligent student said, Melanie, this is quite confusing. I don't know. And I think that that's exactly right. It's this uncertainty. It's the demonstration of an uncertainty that Derrida is facilitating in us. What is it to know that one is naked and yet not know one is naked? Can we hold both of those positions at the same time? And in breaking this apart, indeed by deconstructing this, he's poking holes in our certainty of what it is to be moral with respect to covering ourselves and our so-called sex.
Well, it seems to me that the one argument would say that the animals then would respond to Derrida, and I would put my Descartes hat on or put my any other person hat on and say, well, the animals, because they don't know that they're naked, they don't possess morality, and therefore they are not naked. So that argument would say animals are always operating at the level of not knowing, in a sense. But humans are too at the level of not knowing. Isn't this what Derrida is trying to do now? That you can hold this position and have it be both at once. Hmm. So you can't simply say that ascribing a fact of nakedness to an animal, like you said, it's undecidable.
I think it's a really good point. And I think that it's that sense of returning to Descartes. And when Descartes says, I think, therefore I am, what Derrida is saying is it's the knowledge, the knowing that one is naked. I know that I am naked, therefore I am. And when we make sense of because it is naked without existing in nakedness, we are existing in nakedness. And once we exist in nakedness, we have a moral sensibility that ends up encouraging our moral desire to cover ourselves. And this becomes the fundamental moral moment. And in this origin story of the Old Testament, it becomes the origin story of that division between human beings, Adam and Eve, and non-human animals. And it's knowing that they were naked.
It's so interesting to think about the connection to morality, because if it wasn't for that moment of sin, this framework of morality would never have emerged from it. So truly, in the fact that we are moral, we are only moral because we possess sin. We have sinned. It's contingent on the other. And so our capacity for morality is only possible because we have committed sin. And in a sense, then, the fact that we have failed, this is the condition for morality. And it would seem that the argument for morality would be to avoid sin, to avoid failure, when in fact it's impossible to do that, because the condition for you to be moral is to have that primordial failure.
Well, and it's that fault, you know, it's sort of what comes first. We have an assumption of morality being pure, and yet it is the fault of man to actually create the conditions for morality. So in the Garden of Eden, before Eve took a bite of the apple, before that moment, there is no morality. Morality only occurs by virtue of a fault, and that fault conditions the establishment of a moral system that works to distinguish humans from non-human animals. But it's so kind of messed up that the privilege of being moral vis-a-vis non-human animals is only made possible because of a sin.
This whole notion of privilege is also so fascinating, because what we explored in our previous discussion on Derrida is that he critiques the notion of the human privilege versus the non-human, that in this whole idea of a binary or dualism, there's always a privileging of one over the other. And so there is always a privileging of the human as opposed to the animal or the other, when in fact, when we think about it, the animal has not committed sin. In a sense, they're closer to perfection in a way than the human. And so how do we hold that privilege over the non-privileged, the animal, when they are more perfect?
Well, this is right. You know, it's the sense of, you know, returning to that line where Derrida says something about the relation between good and evil, not being naked, therefore, not having knowledge of their nudity, in short, without consciousness of good and evil, that non-human animals presumably don't have consciousness. I mean, so this argument goes, therefore they cannot be moral, but the privilege of establishing morality as being the virtue of the human is, and the elevation of the virtue of the human is one that presupposes evil or general badness, and yet the non-human animal is the morally pure in this new logic.
So effectively, human imperfection is what gave rise to this valorization of the human over the animal.
It's the separation between no longer perfect. You know, it's the separation from divine perfection in the Garden of Eden, and the transgression of the human creates the conditions for imperfection, and therefore that profound separation that gives rise to human finitude and human just the limits of what it is to be human, which in some ways, now that I think about it, means that in this equivalency, animals, non-human animals, are extensions of that divine nature. So if the limit of the human is the animal is still equivalent to the divine.
Oh, That's interesting.
Yeah. So it's that part is really curious, and so the fact of this kind of deconstruction, that is, of these divisions where we try to distinguish between the me and the not me, or the thing and the not thing, helps us to establish then what are the limits of the human. And ultimately, what are the limits of the animal? And in this opposition between the human-animal opposition, the limits of the animal are actually the human.
I think that this is, for Derrida, a really important moment because, and for us, for our discussion of notions of selfhood, when we think of our entire body of history, philosophy, politics, the animal has always been conceptualized as something that even Jeremy Bentham has asked, when it comes to animals, the question is, do they suffer? And that's the moral question, do animals suffer? And for Derrida, it was, of course, animals suffer. But it's not just that animals suffer, it's that we do this further violence to them, not only by eating, not only, but it's by this division of the animal as that being that does not possess reason, does not ask questions, that only is reactionary.
I was just thinking while you were commenting there, I mean, the very fact of claiming a human privilege establishes a certain power. And in bringing up Bentham's observation about suffering, there Derrida ends up playing on the idea that, you know, or poses the question, is suffering a power? Do we have a capacity to suffer? And so building on Bentham's question, you know, the question is not whether they think or eat or hear or what have you. It's can they suffer?
Yeah.
And in posing the question in those terms, can they suffer, poses the question as if it was a power to suffer. And Derrida, for whom there have been many critiques offered that he is apolitical, as you said, this is a moment where he establishes quite a commitment insofar as he says, you know what, suffering isn't a power. One does suffer. One is suffering. And so in reframing the idea that suffering isn't a potential, it's something that is, Derrida ends up paving the way for a political argument that ends up supplementing his philosophical deconstruction.
So there's so much to think about today.
It's been mind-boggling.
That was a nice sound effect to lead us out. You didn't make any jokes this week. Disappointing for our fans.
Well, you know where the jokes are? They are in my fingers.
Oh, I don't follow. I want to stop following.
I'm like, dude, you must know who follows.
So this is what suffering means. Okay.
This is suffering.
Well, thank you again. I can't believe that it's almost over. Next time we'll have to do some serious wrap-up of this these episodes.
It has just been so much fun, Nama. Really, I've so enjoyed doing this. You know what? I reckon we're going to have to think about what is going to take place for season two. Do you think we've got it in us for a second season?
I think we could make it work.
Awesome.
We're not on the charts in Kenya anymore, but that's my big mission.
What happened?
I don't know. Thank you all for listening. We hope that you liked this episode. If you did like it, please give us a rating on iTunes or on Spotify. We want a rating, so, and it helps people find us. I am, and I always already am, Nama Carlin.
And I'm Melanie White. Thanks for listening.
You Can't Say That is a Carlin White collaboration. Francesca Rimi Chang designed our logo. Stephen Hunt composed our theme song.
And Christian Fuentes is the follower.
See you next time.